just one case on our docket this morning for oral argument, and that is Little v. State. If the clerk will announce the case and the appearance of counsel, please.
The court will now call the hearing of Little v. State of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Danny Burns to argue for the appellant, and Mr. Andy Porter to argue for the state.
Mr. Burns, you may proceed.
Thank you.
Hey, please, the court. My name again is Danny Byrne. I'm here for Mr. Jimmy Clinton Little. And basically the issue in this case is a question of fundamental rights. It's constitutional provisions of requiring a non-sex offender to submit to sex offender conditions and treatment. The Court of Criminal Appeals has found and agreed with the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals that it is a constitutional issue that a non-sex offender should not be subjected to the treatment of a sex offender absent substantial findings. The Court of Criminal Appeals, in effect, adopted Mesa v. Livingston from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And I think we should be guided by that. The Fifth Circuit held in Mesa that before a person can be required to be submitting to sex offender counseling, the courts or the state or the prosecuting authorities must jump through certain hoops under due process. Specifically, they must afford the defendant, before they do it, written notice of their intent to impose sex offender conditions. They then have to disclose to the defendant before the hearing, and not at it, disclosure of evidence that will be presented against, in those cases, it's parolees. In this case, we have a probationer. That to enable him to marshal the evidence, to meet that evidence and show that he's not a sex offender and shouldn't be submitted or subjected to sex offender conditions. And at that hearing, he must be permitted to be heard in person. He must be permitted to present documentary evidence. He must be permitted to call witnesses unless there's good cause shown not for not doing that. Basically the same as in a parole revocation hearing, your right to confront your accusers unless there's a very good reason not to do that, such as, you know, subjecting that person to danger of retaliation.
Is the hearing automatic, or does the appellant need to request a hearing after receiving notice?
I submit to the court that since under Mesa, a plain reading of Mesa, that it's required that these provisions be made before they subject the individual to sex offender counseling. In Mesa, the Texas Parole Board, they're still doing it, told the guy, brought the guy in and said, look, we're ordering you to do sex offender counseling. And the people, you know, would start it, obviously, because they didn't want to get their parole revoked, and then would contest it by writs. There is now at least a provision where you can object, and they'll drop that as soon as you have your hearing, because they can't or won't meet these requirements. But, yeah, I believe that before they impose it under Mesa, this is what the state must do. And because of that, and all the conditions on Mr. Little, except for the urine test, is the sex offender conditions. And
well,
the probation.
Work at suitable employment was not part of the sex offender condition, was it?
Well, but he was fired because he allegedly had something on his computer at that time, and he was, in fact, working and trying to get a job. I mean, he had submitted
How do you
every
get past the two violations, the failure to submit a UA and the not working on the 3 months as alleged in the motion. How do you get past those?
It's easy.
Do you ever get to your constitutional issue?
It's very easy on the failure to work. I mean, he got fired. It wasn't like he quit. He didn't quit. He was relieved of his duties. And he was told by the probation officer to seek employment at a certain number of, put in a certain number of applications. I believe it was
seven. 15, but
whatever it was, he complied with that. He was trying to find a job.
Okay, the fact that in condition in the order as it's written, most of them I've seen says, say, work faithfully in suitable employment as far as possible. But that's
correct.
Not what this order said. It said work. And they alleged he didn't work. And he didn't work.
How can the court impose upon a person an impossible condition? That's a violation of due process in and of itself.
Did you raise that at the trial court, impossibility?
Yes, Your Honor. We showed that he had done what they had told him to do. But that's the other part. The probation officer was the one directing how he would seek employment. And the probation officer admitted at the hearing that he did, more, actually, than he was required to do by her in seeking employment. We're in the middle of a recession. We can't, a lot of people are out of work and they can't find jobs. And they don't have the onus of a probation on their back when they go to apply for jobs.
Let me ask
so that's
you
a problem.
The Court of Criminal Appeals has found that some conditions, violations of conditions, must be done willfully, such as failure to pay or failure to pay child support.
Correct.
Are you familiar with any case that imposes proof of a willful violation on the state for any other condition other than failure to pay or failure to pay child support?
Other than due process, no case law. Other than obvious due process, if it can't be done, you can't be revoked. The other part is the requirement that you work. He was working, in effect. He wasn't getting paid for it, but he was out looking for jobs. I mean, that, in effect, was a work that was imposed upon him by the probation department.
Well, it says work and faithfully at suitable employment, so he really wasn't working at suitable employment.
But he was doing what the probation office told him to do, which was seek that employment, and he sought it, and he sought it faithfully, and he sought it hard. I don't see how the court could conceivably find that a person who has put out 15 applications, not just to the type of work he was trained for, the high employment type, high dollar type employment, he was putting places putting applications into service jobs, McDonald's, and I don't think he ever put a McDonald's, but it was some fast food place looking for employment. So I don't see how he could be held to be violating that condition. On the failure to submit a UA, there's two problems with that, of course. One is he really didn't violate the order. He came to report. They told him to give a UA. He couldn't give it. It was late in the afternoon, like he was normally due after work. And that when he did, was not able to, they got tired of waiting. They told him to come back in the morning and give the UA, which he did. And it is, according to the order, submit to a UA. There's no specifics on the order for the UA, which is kind of a problem under Raines, but the probation officer was the one to determine when, where, and how the UA would be given. They didn't want to wait any longer, so they told him to come back in the morning. He was there first thing in the morning, as reflected by the testimony of the probation officer, and he gave a clean UA. Had he been dirty the night before, he would have still been dirty the next morning, but he was trying. And it was not a scheduled UA. It was just one that they, as is usually done, random. they said, since you're here reporting, we want you to give us a UA. You'd just gone to the restroom before you came in, and it took time. And they didn't want to wait any longer, and so they told him to come back in the morning, which he did, which he got a gave a UA, which was clean, perfectly clean.
Let's go back to your constitutional question, because I have two questions there.
I'm sorry.
What happened to the writ of habeas corpus that he filed?
Your Honor, we filed the writ. She refused to hear it during the hearing, and once she revoked him, she dismissed it as a as moot. I don't think that it is moot, but I don't think that's an appealable order either.
Is that on the record that we have that she refused to hear it?
Yes, Your Honor, two or three times I have said in the record that, Your Honor, we are asking the hearing, and she said, no, we're not going to hear it at this time. We've put that off. We're going to hear that later. And she did not hear the writ, but we had filed in accordance with the motion. This is another thing. You have to have a fair and impartial hearing officer. We filed a motion under the rules to amend the conditions of community supervision before you could file a writ. We was anticipating filing the writ and did file it eventually. And we've got all the issues laid out in the case law, except for the Court of Criminal Appeals case, in the motion to amend conditions of community service. That motion was presented to the court on April 21st, 2011, at 10:27 a.m. Then miraculously, suddenly, that afternoon, she's signing a motion to revoke his probation. She denied the motion it was instantaneous. We filed it, we took it over to her, showed it to her, she denied it right then.
So when you had the hearing, let me clarify one thing. When you had the hearing, it was only on the revocation, and she did not hear your motion to amend the conditions of community supervision at all?
That's correct. She did not hear the motion. She simply denied it without a hearing. And that's reflected by the time that she put on the order, which I don't have a copy of the order.
One thing that distinguishes this case factually from Mesa is that in the original plea, the original plea, he had sex offender evaluation and treatment as directed. That was a condition of his probation. So this isn't just something that was totally, he was blindsided later on by amendments of conditions, correct?
He did have that as a condition originally. He obviously didn't know he could contest that at the time, but that was put on there. The attorney probably didn't know it either, but the problem was until we started bringing up D'Angelo, the case law has been there forever. Well, not forever, since 68. I think it was 68. Whenever the Supreme Court came out with a similar case on the issue of having to register as a sex offender. Also, VTEC, Minnesota v. Murphy, from 84, I'm sorry, since 1984 in the Minnesota v. Murphy, this type of claim has been there. That was on the right to remain silent when you're ordered to submit to questioning on things that are not a part of your probation. And that's the same thing here. His probation was not for a sex offense. The state couldn't prove a sex offense. If they could have proven a sex offense, he would have been convicted of a sex offense.
Well, we don't know that. This was a plea bargain, and oftentimes things are plea bargained down, and everybody has their reasons, and we're not going to assume what they were. What's your response to their argument that he acquiesced or that he's stopped from bringing this up after having complied with the terms and conditions for 3 years or however long it was.
I still think that he is not stopped from bringing up a constitutional claim, especially when the Court of Criminal Appeals and this court, also in DeAngelo, found the violations and found that this was not a proper manner of imposing condition. It's not a proper condition of sex offender. Sex offender counseling is not a proper conviction or condition of probation for a person who is not a sex offender, absent the MESA guidelines of the hearing. So I believe he can raise that at any time. The fact that he was being subjected to maintenance polygraphs, all that, and never failed a single one.
Mr. Burns, your time has expired.
Yes, and we appreciate it. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Andy Porter. I represent the state of Texas. I'd like to start off and work a little bit in reverse order with the court's indulgence. First, with respect to DeAngelo, this case is not DeAngelo. DeAngelo had to do with the propriety of specific questions asked during a maintenance polygraph of Mr. DeAngelo, having to do with whether or not it violated his constitutional right of protection against self-incrimination. That's not the case here. The appellant here did, in his motion to amend conditions, challenge the propriety of sex offender conditions as far as the maintenance polygraph. That was spelled out in the motion to amend. But the motion to amend the conditions did not address the social networking provision, did not address the prohibition against viewing pornography or adult websites on the internet, did not address the propriety of whether or not the trial court's requirement that the appellant work faithfully in suitable employment, and the motion to amend conditions did not address the propriety of the trial court's requirement that he provide urine samples at the direction of the probation office. So to the extent that the appellant now contends his motion to amend addressed and preserved those specific issues for addressing by this court, I don't think the appellate record will support that preservation claim on behalf of the appellant.
Some of those conditions are sex offender conditions and wouldn't have been imposed if he hadn't been on the sex offender caseload. So an objection to the conditions of a sex offender caseload seems to include all the conditions that are imposed only for those who are on the sex offender caseload. So that's the polygraph, because burglars don't take polygraphs. Murderers don't take polygraphs. Just sex offender caseload folks take polygraphs. So I think an objection to the sex offender caseload condition has to include an objection to the sex offender caseload conditions. But work faithfully at suitable employment. The urine, the UAs, were they a condition of probation?
Yes, ma'am. That would be paragraph 1.
That provided UA when requested?
I believe so, Your Honor. And if I remember correctly, I want to get this. It is page 75 of the clerk's record, and it's paragraph 1 of the conditions of community supervision required him to give a UA. And that was part of the original conditions that were imposed by the trial court when he was placed on probation originally for this offense.
What about the writ? Does the writ not preserve these issues?
We don't have a record of that writ before us in this case, so we don't know, unfortunately. I would like to know what the writ says. I wish it were part of this record, because I think the third, fourth, and fifth issues are a lot of fun. From a personal standpoint, in criminal law, most of the constitutional issues are settled, but this is a new frontier for sex offender conditions. I think it'd be a lot of fun to get to argue, but it's not before the court. It wasn't preserved. It wasn't appealed.
So I guess the writ is a separate civil case that was filed. filed, so it didn't get into this record.
That's my understanding, Your Honor. But it's outside the record, so I don't know.
You can't appeal denial of a writ. You can only appeal denial of a writ, right?
Oh, I think... And there are some things he could do to seek relief if he could show that the denial of a writ was, you know, abuse of ministerial duty or something like that. He might be able to seek relief from this court. It's hard to do on a writ. Very narrow circumstances where this court could ever reach the merits. But sometimes a writ is appealable to this court and then on to the...
Well, not denial of a writ, denial of relief.
Denial of relief.
And she denied the writ itself.
That's my understanding, but whether it was denied or dismissed, again, is outside the record. We don't know. So I'm not in a position to answer that question because it's not in the appellate record in this case. I wish I knew.
He said it was dismissed as moot. That's what Mr. Burns said. And I don't know if that's in the record or not, but I guess we'll find
it. It's not in the record, Your Honor.
Okay. I have a question. Why would he have to include in his motion to amend conditions an objection to the requirement of working when it wasn't the requirement of working that is really his objection? It's the interpretation as to whether he is complying with both the order and then the probation officer's directions to look for new work.
To give the trial court notice of what his complaint is, to give the trial court a chance to rule on the objection he's now raising on appeal, the trial court didn't have any notice that he was going to complain that work faithfully, period, did not include, you know, go out and seek employment.
But can he raise that after the revocation hearing?
If he didn't raise it before the trial court, if he didn't raise it in a motion for new trial, if he didn't preserve that issue in the trial court, respectfully, no, Your Honor, he can't raise it now on appeal. He's got to give the trial court a bite at the apple first to blindside the court, sandbag the court.
Wait a minute. You don't blindside and sandbag the court when the state has the burden of proof and you're in there saying, no, I didn't violate this condition of probation. The court knows you're not conceding, you don't plead true. I mean, if you plead true and then complain about being revoked for that, that's one thing. But if you stand mute and they enter a plea of not true on your behalf, or you plead not true, then the issue has been joined. There is an issue in controversy, and the court's well aware of it.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor, except to the extent, I would disagree respectfully, that the trial court has one interpretation of the condition of probation, and that's that he worked faithfully, period. If the appellant had a different interpretation, or if he thought that he was satisfying that, he had a duty to put the trial court on notice that, hey, here's my argument. He was a loser at trial. And on appeal, we've got to examine the trial court's judgment in the light most favorable to the trial court's ultimate ruling. That's what's required by the standard review. Now, a reasonable jurist may disagree, but looking at the trial court's judgment, the conditions of probation, the motion to revoke community supervision, and the trial court's ultimate ruling, looking at all that in light most favorable to the trial court's ruling, the evidence in this case supports the finding, A, that the defendant failed to work faithfully in suitable employment as required by condition number 6, that he failed to provide a urine sample as required by condition number 1.
In your motion to revoke, you allege that the defendant failed to work faithfully at suitable employment as far as possible.
You're correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So you're saying, and really, honestly here, these first two violations, the UA and the employment, if it weren't for this other stuff that he did at work, we wouldn't be here right now, would we?
I don't know. I'm not in a position to tell you how Judge Westfall operates her court.
Would the state even go forward on someone who's submitting 15 applications a week? You even say in your brief he didn't get fired for budgetary reasons. Why does that make a difference? Does it say in the order that you have to work faithfully as far as possible unless you get fired for budgetary reasons?
No, ma'am, it did not.
Okay, so why even include that in the brief? I mean, doesn't that show my point?
The point of that line in the brief was to show he was fired and did not work faithfully in suitable employment because he got fired for misconduct.
But you don't allege. You allege the months that he was out of work. Had you alleged the months he was at work and pulling up porn on his computer, maybe you could make that argument. But you allege the months that he was out of work. So that doesn't really fly, does it?
Well, I'd respectfully disagree. It shows that the point of wasn't fired for budgetary reasons was to show that he was fired for misconduct.
Is there a willful component element to these allegations, do you believe, on those two allegations of violations, that he had to willfully not give a urinalysis sample?
Respectfully, I think that's the trial court's discretion. I think it's a little bit harsh. If, for example, he'd been put in the hospital before he was scheduled to come give a UA and was not physically able, I think it's just absurd if a trial court would revoke him because he's in the hospital having a massive heart attack and he didn't show up to give the UA. Is that within the parameters for a trial judge to do that? That's for this court to call. But that's a different situation than we have here.
No, and my question was really more, are you familiar with any case law that imposes on the state the burden to prove that those violations were done willfully?
Off the top of my head, no, Your Honor. I apologize, I don't.
Okay. What about the circumstance when the defendant shows up, tries to give the UA, and the probation officer says, I don't want to wait any longer, which is what I understand happened here. And if the probation officer had been willing to wait longer, would we be here on that issue?
That information's outside the record. It's also outside the record, or it's not included in the record, of how long the probation officer actually waited. And I think you'd kind of need those facts to...
I mean, if you can't go... It wasn't even that he didn't provide any urine specimen. He didn't provide a large enough urine specimen, as I understand from what I read.
Oh, I didn't get that from the record, but I have no reason to question that. I just don't remember that fact from the record. My understanding was that he didn't give any sample, but I may be wrong, and I apologize if I am wrong on that understanding. But still, you know in advance you're going to have to give a sample, and... You know, well, no, but you have a couple of hours' notice. I mean, it's
only
not like you have 5 minutes to get there.
Only that you have to appear, not necessarily that you have to provide your inspection.
Okay, let's take the example of the defendant wants, this was called a stall, according to the appellate record. Let's take the example where the common folklore is that cocaine stays in the system 72 hours, metabolizes, and then after 72 hours, it's out of your system. Say the defendant, 56 hours before he gets the call to give a UA sample, has been smoking crack. Uh-oh, 56 hours. That's not enough time. Let me stall. Let me wait until tomorrow, and my urine sample will come clean.
That's not the record.
It's not in the record, but it's an analogy of why we shouldn't allow stalls to get a pass.
The probation officer could have stayed there, too, until he came up with enough urine. But we have a really common situation where you've got a nice probation officer, the person comes in, they give us a sample, the person tries, there's not enough urine, and if there's not enough urine, there's just not enough. And probation officer said, look, I don't want to wait any longer, come back in the morning. Everybody comes back in the morning. There's a urine sample. Probation officer's happy, and they don't go back and pick this up until they file a motion to revoke. What was the length of time between the failure to provide sufficient urine sample and the motion to revoke?
I don't have that information.
Right after the objection to the condition of probation?
I don't have that information.
To revoke when they file that motion.
You're correct, Your Honor.
And so as soon as they file their motion, there's a motion to revoke, as I understand the record.
Well, my guess, and reading the record, and maybe this is a little bit of states-oriented, that the appellant knew that the motion to revoke was coming down, and so he scrambled to get his motion filed first.
Is that the record?
No, but neither is it in the record that the state filed the motion to revoke in response to his motion to amend conditions. I mean, it's conjecture either way. I'll either reading I think is fair. I think your reading's just as fair as mine is.
Let me ask you one other question. The time's about to expire. Why was the defendant not entitled to procedural due process before the terms and conditions were modified to add additional sex offender conditions?
I think he was entitled to procedural due process.
But he didn't. I mean, and realistically, he was presented with an order that he signed. All the order says is, I received a copy of this. It doesn't say I agree to it. I got any notice of it. It's, this is it. I received it. And then the burden is on him to somehow or another file some sort of objection. That is what you deem to be sufficient procedural due process?
If he had a problem, yes, Your Honor. It's up to him to voice that problem with the trial court, not lay behind the log for 3 years, and accept the modified conditions of probation. If he waits for 3 years, he should be stopped. It should be his duty to preserve that constitutional argument in the trial court. He didn't.
Do you have any case law to really support that? Because I looked at the one case that you had, which was Brown versus State, and it's really not analogous to this case.
Your Honor, I see my time. May I have a moment? It goes back to the general duty to preserve issues, including constitutional issues. There are certain systemic and structural issues. These particular issues are outside that bailiwick, and even constitutional issues, if they're not preserved, they're waived for appeal. And this is such a situation.
Okay, but my question was, do you have any cases to support your position that that's sufficient procedural due process?
In this context of sex offender conditions, there's no probation case out there that I've found, and I've looked all across the nation. There's no case with these specific facts that says having him sign an order is sufficient. But to the contrary, there's no case out there that says having him sign this order is insufficient.
Okay.
For the reasons previously stated as well in this brief, I ask the court to affirm the trial court judgment. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Burns?
Now, with the court's permission, in addressing the states, there was no hearing. As the court has recognized, the motion was filed to amend the conditions of community supervision, filed April 21st, 2011 at 10:27 a.m. The motion to revoke was then filed April 21st, 2011 at 3:33 p.m. The other argument, Your Honor, we have is that clearly we raised the issue of and that is, of course, in the record. We raised the issue of sex offender conditions. In fact, we cited Coleman v. State, which found that sex offender registration and sex offender conditions were unconstitutional. So the state decided, well, we're just going to go back and knock off the registration. And so Coleman still wasn't satisfied, and he went back second time, and the court said, "No, wait, that ain't good enough. Just dropping the sex offender registration, you still got conditions of sex offender counseling and all the other conditions. No, you got to go back and you got to eliminate those or give him the hearing." Obviously, the Texas Parole Board hadn't got the message yet, and so Mesa v. Livingston comes up, and the Fifth Circuit found, and of course, in a probation revocation, we don't have anybody really to sue because, you know, judges have absolute immunity. But they found that, you know, if the parole board kept this up, and I think that's one of the reasons why they don't push the issue as much. The Fifth Circuit Court found that, you know, they had found it this to be unconstitutional so many times that civil suit, the defendants Livingston and Jenkins do not enjoy qualified immunity under the 11th Amendment for imposing sex offender counseling on people who do not have, and Livingston and and Jenkins were the parole commissioners in that case. I don't see how the court could find that the failure to give the UA would be a adequate grounds for revocation. Although I guess you can, it's sort of like a blood test like a test in a DWI. You know, the cop gets to decide whether it's blood or urine. But when you're going to take away somebody's liberty and not just have an evidentiary question, there were three ways they could have got through that. One is they could have taken a blood sample. There's obviously nurses in the jail at all times. They could have taken hair, or they could have simply waited until, you know, having drank some more water or the Cokes that are there or whatever, until he could produce the urine. Therefore, their decision to have him come back in the morning, it was what they were telling him to do, and he did what they told him to do. And the state had mentioned that, I forgot what it was, they said it wasn't there, but if you read the testimony of the probation officer, he was told, you know, to come back. He was told to get these things, and he was complying with what the probation officers were telling him. I don't see how the court could find that he has violated any of his conditions, and it has to be a purposeful, not necessarily a willful, but a purposeful violation. You have to intend to violate the conditions. It's not like driving while intoxicated, where you don't have to intend to do something in order to be violated. And due process, I believe, says that in this case, Mr. Jimmy Clinton Little is entitled to have his probation reinstated. Unless the court has some further questions, I'll rest at this time. Ask the court simply.
I have one other question.
Yes.
We have the original terms and conditions of probation or community supervision in the record, and then the two amendments. Those are in the record?
Yes, sir. Okay. Those are in the record.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mr. Burns and Mr. Porter, thank you for your arguments and your briefing in this case. There are some very interesting and challenging issues in this appeal. So your case is submitted and you are now excused.
Thank you.
Is the court saying it's a sexy case? No. I could.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals.